latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, and just as I go to bring Maury aboard, I've got a issue with the audio from him. Let me, Casey, I may have to have you patch Maury in through the board, all right? Because I'm not gonna. Amazing. This is amazing. Here, hold on. Let me try one more time. If I can pull that back out. All right. Hold on. Let me try this with. Try one more option, and we'll come back. There we go. I got, I think we got it. I think that brings Maury back, doesn't it? Maury.
I'm back.
There we go. My fault, I guess. I'm still, not a technical whiz, by any stretch. makes me think of one of my favorite moments in my favorite year. 2 years at the Sorbonne, and she still gets it wrong. Maury, we
are finding ourselves immersed in this topic, and there's obviously nothing wrong with that. We have a luxury on this show of 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The article last week in the Financial Times, it obviously piqued people's interest. The concept of the groups and their what feels like an outsized influence on the pools and on, frankly, on essentially effective takeout on the rank and file players. And as we've discussed off and on with you for years, going back to that mutual interests visit in 2007, you warned the industry about the dangers of this and that they had to be kept in check. I'd love for you to provide some historic background for people about the evolution of, and the development of the groups and the dialogue that you've been witness to and involved in with the industry and with the tracks themselves about it.
Well, I really haven't in a long time been involved in a discussion with the tracks. The history is to the best of my knowledge, this was first a Hong Kong phenomenon, also an Australian phenomenon, and they came over here, two large groups, in the late 90s. Their appearance coincided with the appearance of rebating, in large part because the takeouts were so high that in the absence of discounted pricing, I don't think anybody thought there was an opportunity. It started with two very large players. It has grown significantly since then. There used to be basically all independent shops. That changed first with Churchill buying IRG, a purchase that through UBet. That purchase really didn't work out, and IRG ended up being closed. The other is the Stronach Group buying Elite, which continues to this day and is now an ownership shared by Stronach and Naira. And during the process of that, the number of groups has grown significantly. And they now comprise, estimates are basically informed guesses because we don't have data on most of the states, but it certainly appears to be a quarter of the handle, and in some pools it is far more than a quarter of the handle. The more complicated the pools, the larger their participation, with the exception of they don't seem to participate a lot in the single ticket bets until there are mandatory payouts, for the obvious reason that the takeouts are so high. That doesn't mean that there aren't individual players who are taking shots at those bets, but it does mean that they are not the ones who are generating the enormous carryovers that's far more the public.
Maury, take a minute as well, because we did talk rebates with the rebate structure and that evolution with Dick earlier. But explain the financial foundation and concept that the groups are working under. What their aim is. How they are approaching the game.
Their aim is profit maximization, just as with any business. The rebate, of course, is part of the bottom line, so that will enter their calculations as to how much is appropriate to bet and what return they are looking for. But essentially, rebating made all of this possible. The real problem here has always been the takeout rates were exceptionally high in horse racing relative to other gambling games, with the exception of the lottery. And the typical standard by the 80s was sort of 17, 19, 25 in the East. It was a little lower in California, but those were, it was more like 15, 20 in California. But those were the takeout rates. And if you compare that with betting a sporting event, if you compare that with betting in poker, if you compare that with slot machines, blackjack, a whole variety of gambling games, racing was far higher priced than all the others. This changed because racetracks started selling their signal, and in the beginning they sold it extremely cheaply, and they sold it to basically most comers, and people realized if I'm paying $3 and that you're charging $20, there's plenty of margin for the person who's paying $3 to give some of that back to the person who was paying $20. And that is where rebates started. The industry didn't appreciate it at the beginning. There was a conference in 2004, which indeed the economist who was running the conference said, you're not charging enough. I think the racetracks already knew that, but that was the impetus for a substantial increase in simulcast signals to places that didn't have horse racing. And so after that, you saw declines in handle simply because the racetracks were getting a larger share of the betting dollars at those places, and bettors were getting a smaller share. And that's pretty much been the model ever since. The reason handle has become a meaningless number and takeout has become a meaningless number in some sense is because that's not in fact what is determining what is wagered. What's determining what is wagered is what the net takeout is, which is the takeout officially minus whatever the rebate is. And different customers have very different rebates. If you're a retail customer, you're paying the listed price. If you're a customer at a discount house or a rebate shop, you're paying a much lower price. And so it doesn't really tell you anything anymore what handle is, even though that's the metric everyone uses, because that tells you nothing about revenue, which is in fact the relevant number. A lot of the handle that we have today is being propped up by the rebate players, especially with the computer groups. Nobody outside of the people who sign those contracts has any idea what price the various bettors are paying who are at these places. And of course, the bettors themselves. And that's sort of, that's how we got to this place. But it essentially started because racetracks had no good mechanism for lowering takeouts themselves, and they essentially farmed it out to intermediaries. To this day, you still see really high rates of takeout, even at tracks where, like, say, parks, which are essentially slot houses with horse racing, but they've never really lowered their takeout. It's just sort of, it's a hard thing for racetracks to do because you need to negotiate it with the horsemen and so forth and so on. And that sort of has left the business to third parties who have, or the elite, you might argue, is not really a third party because they're owned by the industry, by players in the industry. But that's been the way it is worked. And this obviously is a bad thing for players who are paying the retail rate. And that's a large part of why you see the huge attrition in real handle in horse racing, is because the players are finding better places to bet and better things to bet on.
Can you quantify for that average player what it means? And Andy Serling coined the term effective takeout, meaning the influence and the value sucking monolith that the computer groups have been. In terms of probing probables and flattening combinations and taking, you know, siphoning value out of particularly exotic pools. I mean, talk about where they're playing and what its effect is on the everyday player in dollars, percentages.
It's hard to talk in percentages because you just don't have that much data. What you can talk about is that the more complicated the bet, the more involved groups are likely to be, because complication is something that works in their favor. You see this in pick fives, in pick sixes, in superfectas, in penefectas, and so forth. The harder the bet, the more the groups are likely to participate. And that's just math. It's much harder to have the right... You need the right bankroll to play those bets, and most people who are just coming in on a Saturday don't have that bankroll. And you also need a way to handicap all the races or all the spots correctly. And the groups are just better at that because they have probabilities associated with every horse. So they, the more complicated the bet, the better it is for them. The reverse of that is also true, which is that the easier the bet is, the better it is for the public. And that's a shameful act of this industry, is the relentless promotion of hard-to-hit bets. Certainly the television stations that broadcast racing do it. The in-house guides do it. Everything that the industry is selling is, in some sense, these harder bets, which is something that the groups are going to excel at, and is something the public is not. And that's why you have such high effective takeout rates in these bets. I can go into that more when we talk about pick sixes, but that's just the math of it. And that's not essentially... The groups built a better model. The groups have better math. They've got talented people working for them. They've got talented people running them. And it's not unexpected that they would excel at this, and they do. There are some places where you can see what the percentages of handle are. In pick fives, it's mind-boggling. And yet, you turn on a television program and all you see is how great the pick five is. No, it's not. It might have a low nominal takeout, but outside of New York, it has the late pick five. It's going to have a high effective takeout because the groups are a substantial percentage of it, and they're better.
My natural follow-up to that is, you know, what you suggest players, where they gravitate, and how do we influence the racetrack marketing machinery to take this into consideration? Obviously, you know, NYRA has already thought it through and is, you know, specifically advertising retail only wagers, including the cross country on weekends and the late pick five the rest of the time. But you got a place like Hawthorne that is lowered the takeout on whips, which should be very attractive and is obviously an initiative that deserves player support. I mean, what is the answer? Maybe two parts, Maury. What is the answer for players in terms of how they should approach this to minimize the effect in terms of their own bankrolls? And what is the racetrack? What should the racetracks be doing? And are they oblivious to this?
Oblivious is a loaded question. I don't think they're oblivious. Again, I think there's an enormous amount of cooperation between between Elite and the Stronach Group. And when we discuss pick sixes, I will sort of give evidence of that. In terms of what the NIRA policy strikes me as a genuinely interesting policy, they've put guardrails around the, at least with the win, place, and show bets, the easiest bets to hit. And with pick the, by protecting the pick five and pick six from basically the handle of the groups, what they have done is they've given people who want to make that bet an opportunity to at least do it in a kinder parimutuel environment. Horse racing's, if you think about it, we don't have, with the exception of Rich Natural Star, five claimers running in the Breeders' Cup. We don't put those horses together. But in parimutuel pools, we essentially do put those horses together because the groups are the equivalent of the Breeders' Cup horses, and the public is the equivalent of the five claimers. And it's not surprising if you put them together who's going to win and who's going to lose. The game is a little bit stacked in that the best players are also given a host of other advantages. One of them you've mentioned is that they're paying a lower price. Another is that they get to bet last. Indeed, often their bets don't show up, at least for some of them, until after the race has begun. So right. They're betting with complete information. The public is betting with no information about what they're doing. So in the end, you have this constant set of complaints about, I bet the horse when he was loading at 10-1 and he went off 6. And that's only the win pool. And that's, as I said, the pool that they're less involved in relative to the more complicated bets. It's the industry's determination that they're going to have those advantages. The industry has absolutely chosen that. And so it's not, again, to me, that's not a problem with the groups. That's a problem with the racetracks who are setting the rules. And if you set the rules so that you can bet last, well, of course you're going to bet last. If you had a poker game where you could always bet last, you wouldn't be saying, no, I'd rather bet third. Betting last is an advantage. And so that's another advantage that the industry has bestowed upon the groups who are, again, already really good and don't need more advantages, but that is a decision that has been made by the business. Why they're doing that is probably because they want the handle and they don't think they'll get as much handle from the groups if they don't accommodate them. But that's, you know, the effect is screamingly obvious when horses get cut sharply, or as, you know, as Pat wrote about in the Gotham, when the exacta gets killed. And that's that again is something that the industry has chosen to allow. It doesn't have to. That's, you know, if I were in that position, I'd want to bet last every time. I don't blame anybody for wanting that. I blame the racetracks for basically accepting it. There's nothing wrong with asking for the world, but nobody has to give you the world.
What are some options on this topic in terms of dialing them back? I made that suggestion. Would they continue to participate? At what point does the cannibalization of each other become a part of the story? Anecdotally, I mean, I've been traveling around the country all year, and the name Dr. Nick and this Elite 17 that is just I think I akin it to one of those creatures in space in Star Trek, you know, basically eating up solar systems. Where does this go, essentially, Maury? And you know, can the racetracks dial them back and put the genie back into a decent sized bottle that everybody can live with?
I mean, if it wants to, of course it can. The first thing you can do is charge higher prices. Basically, if you charge higher signal prices, you'll lower their handle. That's automatic. If that's what the industry wanted to do, it has maybe a blunt weapon, but it has an absolutely effective weapon to accomplish that. There's no evidence whatsoever that that's actually what they want to do. What's going on is kind of instructive in that what most of us had presumed to be a paramutual effect, namely that the more you bet, the more you're betting against yourself. Well, I mean, from the handle that you're seeing from him, that obviously he's so good that the paramutual effect is not mitigating how much he plays. In fact, his handle is growing. And that would, you know, that would suggest that whatever that magic point is, he's not there. Whether other groups are there is a different question, but clearly he's not. You know, especially in the complicated pools, he's an extraordinarily high percentage of them. And if you ever want to get a sense of what the world is like, just sort of sit there with a pen and paper and watch the last minute or two of a mandatory pick six or a mandatory pick five and see the size of those bets that come in. They're enormous. Even on a regular day, just take a look at how much money comes in the last flash at California or Keeneland or any place or Gulfstream, whatever. And you'll just be, this isn't hundreds and 200s coming in. This is gigantic bets all coming in at once. And if, you know, all you can say right now is whatever the number is that it becomes counterproductive, it hasn't been reached yet. It's for the public, it's a different story. But just in terms of the what's happening in the pools now, I mean, you know, we have not reached that point because group participation in general seems to be growing, and in particular, that's Triple E 17.
In response to yesterday, I received some really interesting I'm very appreciative of some of the questions and the information that people, you know, they've got essentially, Maury, they've got dribs and drabs of this, and connected to people who are connected to people that, you know, that hear the stories and are curious about, what is going on behind the scenes. And one of the things, specifically with this Elite 17, that seems to be happening, that is a somewhat new phenomenon, is the hammering in the wind pool of favorites. And in fact, David Bernson, in his quotes in that Financial Times piece, Bernson actually alluded to it when he said, you know, the public is a good barometer with identifying favorites and win candidates. And it seems like, you know, horses that used to be even money or 6-5, 7-5 are now being pounded on a regular basis down to 3-5, 4-5. Is that just anecdotal or incidental or by virtue of some field size issues, or is it Elite 17?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I really haven't tracked that and am not competent to offer an opinion on it. What you can offer an opinion on is that, you know, the late money in this business is the smartest money.
Right.
And so if you see an even money shot drop to 3-5, chances are that the right price was not even money. The right price was closer to 3-5. It probably was under 3-5. And that's just, I mean, we live in a world of big data, for God's sakes.
Yep.
You read it everywhere.
Yep.
And while it, the genius of the early of the people who arrived at this early is that they understood that, and they realized that if you could take blackjack-like probabilities and generate them for horse racing, it gave you enormous opportunities. And that is, fortunes were built on that observation. Horse players may like to think it's art, and maybe to some extent it is, but it's also science. And they have beautifully mathematized the likelihood of winning races. I have nothing but respect for them. They're good.
Well, and in essence, I mean, not to distill it, but you essentially are attributing their presence to, you know, capitalism and opportunity and just the, you know, the factors that are out there. Is this more?
And the racetracks are basically doing everything possible to help them. They're getting assistance from the industry in terms of, you know, they can go into the tote, which means that they can bet at the last second. They get everything, as opposed to, you know, the Saturday bettor in line who may or may not get what he wants and may get shut out and so forth. They don't get shut out as a rule. And they get exactly the array of bets that they would like to have. And they can do it with complete information. Again, this is just a decision by racetracks that's how they want to run their business. My worldview is that this is all that is going on has been designed now by the industry because it's what the industry wants. And if you ask why that is, that's an interesting. You know, that takes us off on a bit of a tangent.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, in the old days, horsemen might have been concerned about this. But for the most part, horsemen are getting their purses not from betting on parimutuel wagering, but from betting on slot machines. And so especially for, you know, tracks where the slot business dominates the handle doesn't matter all that much to them anymore because that's not the source of their revenue. The racetracks are the same thing. An enormous amount of, you know, the vast preponderance of their revenues is now generated by non-racing activity, either on the one hand because of slot licenses or on the other real estate development. And so they don't really have much of an interest in the financial well-being of the long-term financial well-being of the business. You mentioned yesterday, it certainly seems to be the case that when executives are compensated on the basis of handle, well, the best way to increase handle is to lower the prices to the biggest bettors in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And unsurprisingly, that will be incredibly effective. And so again, who decided to have that compensation scheme? The racetracks. So you keep coming back to a situation where, for different reasons, the incentive structures are warped, and has become a god. And the revenue from that handle, which used to be exclusively how horsemen were funded, and now it isn't anymore. So it's just hard to say who is at the table who would have an interest in modifying this. And that's why it's continuing, I think, is that just there's nobody outside of horse players who are voting with their feet by leaving the business. The regular Paul Matisse had a comment the other day to that effect, where just how many people he talked to who
right.
Have exited the game. And that's kind of it, is that You get tired of seeing 10-1 shots go into the gate and go off at 6. You get tired of betting exactas at $120 that go to 74. And you just say, geez, I can bet a football game, and that doesn't happen. Horse racing is the only game where that happens. And so they have, real handle's been declining for 50 years, and horse racing has always found a way to find its profitability, usually from the beneficence of government. And certainly with slot licenses, that was the case. It's just not clear to me who exactly has a long-term stake in horse racing now. You look at the price that Churchill got for selling the land under Calder. I mean, and they sold the casino license there. So Calder was sort of, it was unnecessary to them. Arlington obviously was unnecessary to them. Horse racing itself is not a business with a clear constituency anymore in terms of how it's funded. I don't know the solution to that, but I think that's the case.
Is there, there's obviously a number of moving parts to a response or to a follow-up on this, Maury. Let me first ask, for those that are going to participate and are, you know, want to play and love the game to the extent that you know, this will not dissuade them. What can we do to take into account this influence? What recourse and what approach should we take to adjust our own bankroll application to be competitive? I mean, to be on as close to level footing as we can be.
Bet straight pools in New York. Bet the late pick 5 in New York. Bet the pick 6 in New York when there's a carryover. These are reasonable approaches. If Oaklawn is indeed still a place which doesn't accept betting, then if you don't want to play against the groups, then you could bet. You could bet Oaklawn. Field sizes are good. That would be the easiest answer. A broader, but to me more interesting answer is there's absolutely no entrepreneurship in horse racing. If you live in a state where you have sports betting and so forth, and you go up and look at what kind of bets are available at a DraftKings or at an MGM or a Caesars or whatever, it's so many more interesting things to bet on than win, play, show, exacta, trifecta, super. And many of those are coin flip bets. This group of golfers versus that group of golfers. Will this quarterback be over or under 175 yards throwing? And on and on and on. Horse racing could do the same thing, but there's no interest in doing it. Maybe if you had fixed odds wagering on horse racing, this whole market would emerge. And that will be a pretty darn good place for regular players to be. But right now, we don't have any of those products. The only time they've introduced simple ideas besides the win, place, and show pool, they've been overpriced, and the pools have had no liquidity, and they've disappeared in short order. So the answer is there's a lot more things that you can bet than the menu that horse racing offers, but as far as I can tell, there's almost no interest in exploring that world. The racetrack seemed to be dead set against, or most of the racetrack seemed to be dead set against any sort of fixed odds betting option. Although, as has been pointed out, while they're opposed to it here, they're not opposed to it overseas, where the Stronach Group partners with companies that offer that, in the sense of partnering, they basically allow their signal to be bet at those places. So despite the fact that, you know, handle, especially from the public, seems to decline in real terms every year, the industry doesn't really seem to want to offer products that might interest people in getting involved. And that's one place where I think the public would be wonderfully served. The best bet in horse racing right now is horse tournaments. They are they're good opportunities. They tend to be low takeout. They're a different group. You know, it's a different group of participants. There are plenty of smart tournament players, God knows.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as going up against Elite 17. So that's another place where I would suggest people. Well, and you don't need to, you know, you don't need to play the $10,000 tournaments to have that experience. There are plenty of low denomination tournaments for regular people. So that would, to me, be another. That's another wonderful place for people who don't want the what is now the racetrack experience, who would like a different experience. There's probably been, in many ways, the biggest gambling success for the public is the growth of tournaments. So that would be another thing I would stress. What I would say overwhelmingly is no more than you would listen to a car salesman trying to get you into the car with all the options. It's very unwise to listen to the people touting where you should be betting your money, because that advice is typically self-interested and poor.
I know you've done on that topic, and thinking back to the proliferation of particularly the Rainbow Six, because I know you've studied it. We had a involved discussion when we were trying to figure out its influence and you know what was a smart approach to it. Andy was against it from day one. I remember our late friend Chet Hancock. I mean, Chet had an interesting approach to it. He wasn't worried about, you know, taking down the whole pool. He was just looking to hit daily for, you know, 2,500, 4,800, 6,000, and he had a hell of a run. But what is your reaction to Andy's points about the Rainbow Six, and you know how the industry has just continued to let essentially a usury, you know, a product that is abusive to the players, they've allowed it to continue.
Okay, I mean, I pretty much agree with Andy. I think he has a little bit of a saccharine view of what the world was like in the good old days. just for the record, and I looked this up, when I first got involved in this, the biggest players in that market were some guys called the Philadelphia Group, because they came from Philadelphia. If you're a stock market trader, you know them as Susquehanna Trading. The president of Susquehanna Trading is the 23rd wealthiest person on the Forbes 400. That was the competition. Pretty smart guys, to say the least. So the idea that that was the, you know, that everything was wonderful back then. It was fun. It was better in many ways, but carryover bets have always attracted interesting people into them. That said, Andy did a nice job yesterday of talking about the sort of ridiculousness of playing a very high takeout bet before, you know, essentially it's over 40% typically. I'd rather talk for a minute about what that pool actually does. The reason that pool exists, besides the tracks picking up their 20% every day of, you know, non-trivial amounts of money, you know, you get bigger handle. You certainly get bigger handle on a rainbow pick six than you're going to get on a no carry up for straight pick six. The problem with the rainbow pick six, beyond the ridiculousness of betting something like that with that high a takeout, is what happens on mandatory days. This is, and I'm going to talk about one track because it's the track I've looked at, which is Gulfstream. I think maybe 5-6 years ago, I lose track of time. I came on your show after Gulfstream had run one of these full fields complicated pick sixes and said, hey, the public builds the pool and they're giving them no chance. I've got some hard data on that. It's a little bit misunderstood because the 20-cent numbers don't really, especially for those of us who date back to the days of the $2 pick six, don't quite translate. So I'm going to translate these into $2 numbers. I broke the Gulfstream pick six history through the middle of last year into what I call normal, hard, and extremely hard outcomes. And my definition of normal is basically 20-cent tickets of under $10,000, which is the equivalent of a $2 ticket under $100,000. And, you know, for a pick six, $80,000 or $100,000 ticket on a $2 bet, that's might be, many people say that's the high end of normal. But I use that as normal. Then I took $10,000 to $25,000. And then I took over $25,000. Now, again, if you're talking about over $25,000 on a 20-cent bet, you're talking about over $250,000 on a $2 bet. And for those of us who go back long enough, there weren't all that many $250,000 payouts. That would be unusual. So anyway, Gulfstream basically, out of 31 tickets, they split evenly between normal, hard, and extremely hard. The normal ones, there were three times when the carryover was over $1 million, 3 out of 11. For the harder ones, it was basically slightly over half of the carryovers were over $1 million. So basically, Gulfstream is orchestrating harder pick sixes when the carryover goes up. Field size as well. Field size was smaller on the ones with, unsurprisingly, on the ones with normal outcomes than it was on the hard and the very hard. The very hard outcomes had the highest field size. The effective takeout on these, and again, this because of the way the data is assembled, this isn't takeout for the pick six. This is takeout for the day. Now, and we're back in Andy's, you know, what Andy Sterling calls effective takeout, whatever phrase you want. It's, but you shouldn't be paying the same takeout on mandatory days as you should on non-mandatory days because that carryover is being returned to the public. So it should lower the effective takeout by the percentage of money that comes from the carryover over the total handle.
Right.
So if you have $1 million carryover and you have a $10 million handle for the day, that should lower the takeout. Instead of having, let us say, $8 million paid out, you're having $9 million paid out. So you would expect that that would be the case. For the public on the hard and very hard days, the takeout was 26% for the day. For the normal day, it was about 21%. What you don't see is less than the average takeout. So you ask, why is that the case? Well, it's the case because who's winning? And the people that are winning disproportionately to are the people who put together the best tickets, and the people who get to bet late, and the people who have the best handicapping methodologies. And so what's essentially the race, what Gulfstream has done, is redistributed money from the public who's building the carryover and handed it to their customers, mostly at elite. Pat talked about one of these examples yesterday. My favorite was there was a ticket in 2021 where I believe 10 of the 11 winning tickets were held by people at the shops. This isn't an accident. This is a deliberate decision by the racetracks by Gulfstream to make the six races as hard as they can. Usually it's going to be full fields. It's often going to be very competitive turf races. And by doing that, the public can't get deep enough because they don't have the bankrolls and they don't have the skill. The people who have that are the people that Gulfstream is basically helping manufacture these outcomes for. Now, that's a decision by the racetrack. They don't have to do that. Sometimes you look on a Saturday card with a giveaway and they make a maiden 12-5 with 14 the first race. Not doing that for the public. You're just making that hard for the public. And you're making it better for the people who can cover more combinations. Now, that's their policy. You could argue it's their pool, and it certainly is. But that is what they see fit to do with the Rainbow Six, is basically have a very high takeout bet for almost all of the days. And then on the day when it isn't a high takeout, constructed in such a way that it continues to be a very high takeout for the public. And that's, again, I keep coming back to this. This is all things that have been determined by the racetracks. And once upon a time, maybe you had a more effective regulatory system. But these days, regulators don't really seem to be have much to say about this. So, well, I guess you would say that the regulators have approved that. When I was in graduate school, they would talk about how regulatory bodies are often captured by the industries that they regulate, and you don't see anything here which would suggest otherwise. That again is, that's the structure of the business.
When really all they would have to do to level the playing field somewhat is to have a couple of the races out of the six, be a reasonable size field, 7 horse, 5 horse field, heavy favorite, a likely winner in a spot, that would basically give the rank and file player a fighting chance.
And when you see 6 horse stakes taken out of the sequence, it probably should tell you that should be an alert that they aren't really interested in making your life simple as a better. I think it's unconscionable the way that pool has been manipulated to produce those outcomes. And again, I attribute that entirely to the racetrack, which decides what races are going to be included in the sequence. And once again, if you turn on, the hype and promotion of these bets makes you think that it's a good opportunity. The results tell you, no, it's not. And again, when people with vested interests are telling you to do something, you're probably best off taking a deep breath and saying, let me think about this.
Well, there'll be plenty of people thinking about this after these 2 days of conversation, if they hadn't already. Maury, got about, figure another 8-10 minutes, make it an even hour. What do you think is the future? And short-term and intermediate and long. And I guarantee you there are some racetrack management and marketing people that are listening that I hope are realizing they may have a marketing opportunity.
Well, you could argue they've got a marketing opportunity because what they've been doing up until now is, you know, doing everything possible to discourage people from participating. One of the things that I come back to is the lack of entrepreneurship in this business. There should be people sitting around thinking about, probably people thinking about what bets they like to make when they're not in horse, when they're not involved in horse racing. You know, when they're what they like to do in their fantasy leagues, what they like to do when they're betting football on a Sunday. There's so many different products. You know, you could have in-race wagering. It would be hard, but you could do it. There are just so many possibilities of products that are don't exist today that would exist in a world where you started from scratch. Instead, what we seem to do is just replicate the bets that existed, you know, 30 and 40 years ago, and add a horse or maybe cut the minimum wager in half or whatever. But there's no, essentially these bets are, yeah, and really the new bet that is the new bet of the last 20 years was the Rainbow Pick Six, and that's been discussed quite a bit on your show.
Yeah.
And that bet was basically designed to take advantage of the public. You know, it doesn't feel like what we need is harder and harder lottery-type bets. Powerball is their game. What you need is bets that people can win at, and bets where, you know, the whole attractiveness of fixed prices, that you actually know what price you're getting when you make your bet, and you don't have unpleasant surprises after the bell. I mean, I think that at some level, racetracks have to, at some point, realize just how much, how unpleasant they are making the experience for their customers, and think about ways to make it more attractive. Now, they have done some of that. TVG and Fox Sports and so forth have done something that really wasn't available a long time ago, which is racing in your house. TwinSpires on the computer, and ExpressBet on the computer, and so forth. This is a huge improvement in the distribution of the game, and it's probably another reason that the handle numbers are so disappointing. Is you've had the wind has been at racing's back in terms of distribution, but handle continues to decline in real terms. That would be my that would sort of be where I would think that horse, another thing which Pat talks about, it's rules and transparency. You turn on a baseball game and my God, they've got a K zone up there so you can second guess the umpire's home strikes. They've got replay, so you can see things down to the millisecond in terms of whether the runner was safe or not. And horse racing continues to sort of have this policy where you don't really understand why horses are DQ'd. It's just a night and day experience between what you have in the rest of the world and what you have here. That's another area which could be tremendously improved and has been tremendously improved elsewhere, just not here. And once again, it seems to me that the industry just recycles things that it has been doing forever. And that's another place where you could really, really improve the experience. Everything in this business seems to occur behind a curtain. I don't know who's, I don't know what, who thinks that's a good idea, but it isn't the case that people don't know it just because you're not telling them. They know it because they see it every day. And I remember when this was an idea that was floated briefly back in that long ago panel of having somewhere where if you have concerns about a ride or you have concerns about a horse's performance or whatever, you could just call, I think it was called an ombudsman, the equivalent of the sort of the horse, a horse racing equivalent to the newspaper position. And you could say, hey, what about this?
Yeah.
There's no way, if you're angry about a ride, who exactly do you call? I have no idea. I guess you could call the stewards, but they wouldn't welcome your,
no.
They wouldn't welcome you. There's just no, so, and this goes through, I mean, it's completely off topic, but it's the God's honest truth. When did we learn what Service and Navarro were doing? Not from the industry. We learned that from the involvement of the federal government. The industry never seems to have an interest in exploring those situations too closely. Maybe they lack the tools. Maybe they lack the, they don't want to devote the resources to it. But how many times in our lives do you think the federal government is going to get involved in a horse racing matter? Not too many. They got better things to do. But that's really the only time that I can remember in recent memory that you've actually had someone involved. Horse racing's answer continues to be, if you don't talk about it, no one will notice. Well, they do. It's and so that's something else I would tell the marketing people is you've got to get out in front of things instead of just thinking that no one sees it. And a lot of times the people who see it are some very good customers. And again, there are other games to play. There are other skill games to play. Horse racing isn't the only market where you can hope to have a good opinion and win money gambling. But that's sort of, it started out as a monopoly, and that's still the mindset to which it's been mixed up.
Along these lines, and I will slip in that the ombudsman concept, when I was at, when we were at Symposium, and we had the 45 ideas in 45 minutes session, one of the five, or not, well, I guess we each did nine things. So one of the nine that I floated was a just exactly that, an ombudsman with each track, essentially a customer service liaison that people could reach out to that would then and go source answers. That is something that would be really well received by every level of stakeholder, horse player, and fan. I'm so glad you brought that out. One thing we touched on a little bit, Maury, that you know is being floated as a potential, not necessarily a panacea, but potentially a salve, would be fixed odds. What is your fixed odds feel, and how much of a resource could it be in combating price fluctuation or price depression?
It should be a wonderful tool for that. It would also have the effect of actually giving the public a far better line than the morning line, because it's amazing how much better people do it whose money is at stake than people who do it in 15 minutes or a half hour or whatever, certainly for the overworked ones. And so it would be a win from that point. It would also be good to be able to lock in a price, although I am of the opinion that more of the benefit from fixed odds wagering would be in the products that were offered than in just, you know, the fact that you could get a fixed price in a win pool. Just the number of things you can bet on is only limited by people's imagination, especially if you're dealing with fixed odds, so you don't need the you don't have the liquidity concerns that you have in parimutuel wagering. I'm a huge fan of that idea. Again, it just doesn't seem like the racetracks have exhibited much interest in it. You know, Betfair in England is gigantic, you know, it offers the chance for professionals to be price setters, and it offers the chance for bettors to just get the price they bet at. That sort of thing would be welcome here, but whether it's going to happen or not is pretty much up to whether the industry wants it to happen. But fixed odds to me are, the win pool is just the tip of the iceberg for fixed odds. That the richness of betting options would probably in the long run be a more important component of that than just that you actually know you're getting 3-1 to win. Knowing you're getting 3-1 to win is wonderful, but I think the game is incredibly undermarketed in terms of the things you could be betting on that you're not.
That would say to me that one resource we might be underutilizing is an organization like Caesars that seems to like racing and has people in, I imagine, right, in their operation that are specifically busy creating odds. I mean, I don't necessarily think that the racetracks, that the rank and file marketing people have that experience in terms of creating those kinds of clever, the clever markets that you're alluding to. But wouldn't the gaming operations, wouldn't they be a good resource for that? They've got to have people, right, in those offices.
Absolutely. Hey, FanDuel owns CBG.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They, if there was interest, there would be product. You know, you think of Caesars used to be William Hill before it was sold. William Hill, of course, was invested in the United States, but it's a British bookmaking company. There are people who do this. You know, they are professionals who set prices. In horse racing, to the extent that happens at all anymore, it's about four times. You know, you've got this. I'm not talking about offshores where there may be more activity, but you've got the Triple Crown races and the Breeders' Cup, and that's essentially the only time you see anything involving sort of casinos offering
future
a different menu.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, and in fact, on that topic, I did see yesterday that the Preakness is going to offer a Preakness future wager. At least somebody, a little something. The Derby future wager continues to be, not entirely maximizing its opportunity, but it seems to be making slow strides. Steve Crist for years said there's no reason why we shouldn't be able, at the two-year-old market, you look at the two-year-olds and get a future wager on virtually any two-year-old that we think could win the Derby, and all it would take would be one person to win at 5,000 to 1 on some two-year-old that they identified in September as a Derby winner. I mean, it would be really marketable. I mean, you're right, Mark. You're talking to Maury Wolf ostensibly about the CAW money and the organization, but it has morphed into a much wider discussion about the way in which the industry markets itself and the way in which it isn't seemingly giving players their best chance to be successful or the best chance to take an interest in the sport. And we absolutely, with the competition from sports betting, I mean, Maury, talk about your own betting, because you're a big baseball bettor. We've talked about it before. I mean, how has your personal handle changed in over the years vis-a-vis sports betting?
Well, what changed more than anything in baseball was with the increasing competition. My interest was always baseball futures. And that became a much more liquid market, that instead of being limited to 300 or 500, you could bet thousands of dollars on the open. And so the opportunities changed. Now, the lines have also gotten better, but the opportunities changed if you had an opinion, because you could bet more money. And that is... that is always the problem with fixed odds wagering, is that is how much can you bet. But baseball opened up dramatically when I think it's simply a function of more competition in the space, and more competition in the space meant that people were more either had to offer better bet sizes, or chose to, because there was just more. They realized there would be more liquidity in the overall market. I've got a friend who bets golf. I'm astounded at the things you can bet in golf. You can bet. Who won a group of players that went to one SEC school versus a group of players that graduated from another SEC school. Korea, you'll have Asia versus Europe, all of these kinds of things, Asian players versus European players. And maybe inside Asia, you'll have Korean players versus Japanese players versus Chinese players, and on and on and on. There's really no limit to what kinds of things you can come up with if you're clever. As well as, I've always thought horse props are tremendous fun. There aren't too many times in life when you can finish 15th and win a bet. But in horse props, you can.
Yeah.
It's never going to work the way, it's never going to work as sort of the high takeout bet that, and parimutuel bet that is being offered by Trax. Again, who wants to bet at a minute to post on plus 130 and end up getting minus 180? No sense in doing it. But that's, as long as you have it in the parimutuel format, that's the risk you're going to run. And it just strikes me that if the industry you'd have to contract it out, because you're right, the industry itself is not going to be the one to come up with that, with those lines. But there are people who've been doing it for, the bookmakers in England have been doing it for however many years. Bookmakers in Australia, They're used to this. It would be a much more interesting product if you allowed a competitive market to operate, instead of what we have now, which is basically, you know, a limited number of racetracks, limited even more by the fact that ownership is consolidated in them. And if they don't want it to happen, again, it's not going to happen.
You said something just now as we kind of pull everything together and wrap it up, Maury. You mentioned Australia and the UK, and it is notable how much investment the Australian bookmakers, their interest in the American market. I think of SI. We've had conversations with SIS and with bet makers. We've got our friends from Form to Win that have come to these shores. It is encouraging that those type of operations believe there's a future here. I mean, they wouldn't be investing the way they are if they didn't think that the American racing marketplace had a future.
I think the most pessimistic people about the future of American racing are the people that run racetracks.
Well, that's a sad comment. I mean, that's just disheartening to think, honestly. Yeah. We can't end on that note. So,
okay.
put a happy face on this if you can.
it's what we said. The opportunities are out there. They just have to be capitalized on.
Yeah.
My God, think about the transition in 5 years or so. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying the transition from the opinion of professional sports leagues about gambling 5 years ago
right.
to what you see on any sports broadcast today. You know, the announcers are saying, "I'll bet the announcers are coming up with a prop that they like." Everybody's picking the game, on and on and on. It almost seems, not only are they partners, it seems like they're in bed together. But that is the kind of change that is possible. I mean, if I told you 10 years ago that this would be this is what a television broadcast of a sporting event would look like in 2023, you'd have thought I was out of my mind. But in fact, change happens, not always for the better, but it happens. And that's sort of, you know, essentially horse racing seems to be slow on the uptake there. But yeah, there you can change this. You can change this for the better. It doesn't. The model that exists today doesn't have to be the model forever. It just needs, you know, it needs young people. It needs new people who look at the world differently.
Well framed and a hopeful message to wrap it up, Maury. As always, the time invaluably spent with you. I appreciate the opportunity to let you kind of meander through this with me and help people better understand what we're facing and how to approach it. And the bottom line is that. Those of us that care the most about the game, we want a future, and we want it to be a viable sport for years to come. But we got to get a message out there, and we have to get a response. And all we can do is shed light on these topics and keep pressing forward.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me. Pleasure talking to you.
Maury Wolf, everybody. An expansive mind and a perfect example of one of the kinds of people that are drawn to this game. I mean, it's no accident that we have so many mathematicians and you know, are arbitrage types and you know, day trading types, and we, you know, we've got a puzzle solving entity that people enjoy, people that, you know, like. Chris Lamy talked about this in his contribution to the Financial Times article. We've got a fascinating game, and we can make it more appealing in so many different ways. So don't be discouraged. Thanks to, this was a three-guest morning. Dick Powell, Sid Fernando, and Maury Wolf, this last 85 minutes or so. If you missed anything, replay 6 to 9 tomorrow. Archive, podcast, etc. as well. And back with you tomorrow to dive into Wood Memorial, Bluegrass, Santa Anita Derby, and the accompanying undercards. That'll make this weekend, in this case, the... Is it the first? It's the second Saturday? Fifth? Sixth? Seventh? Yeah, the second Saturday of April, leading toward the first Saturday of May. Special. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it. Talk to you tomorrow.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding